Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Trenkberg. Hey, Kirk, good talking to you again.
Hey, Fred, it's good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Now, you were offline there. You were telling me that you did you talk your brother into getting a pinball machine, or you just wanted another project to work on?
I just spread the fever. We went out and played a few places, and you know, he's done this before, and we've also talked about it previously, but this time he acted on it and actually purchased a new one in box and had it shipped to his house, which
And you were doing remote customer service.
Yes, I was. He called me several times to say, what are these parts for? And, you know, how do I do this? Yeah, where's this go? And things like that. So thank goodness for our phones having, you know, video audios and do real live, FaceTime and things like that allows us to do this.
Did you have remote. Him open up the play field and then say, don't touch that. Don't touch that.
Yeah. Yeah. He said, how do I turn it on?
Well, they hide the buttons, you know.
Well, it's funny. The absolute traditional place for a switch for all pinball machines, everyone has ever been manufactured that I know of, has been under the right bottom of the right chassis, right under the right flipper, sort of where the bottom near the legs, and it's a switch, toggle switch underneath. Now, the big manufacturer, Stern, decided to make it easier for them to, I think, get an EMI or a FCC certification on the what's called the back box, which has just mostly computing devices. And they actually went and put the switch underneath the lip of the back box and the top. So you have to stretch over the machine. And that was, I don't know. They control 80% of the market. So that's what you get.
This is what you get.
You can do what you get to do. You decide you want to change a traditional location of something that's lasted for decades, and you can do it because you have,
the clout. You can do it.
People don't have any choice. So, anyway, you had a question.
I got an email, and let's see. It's a failure rate question was the topic of it. And so they're using failure rate as a metric, and that wasn't really the question. It was, what do we include in calculating a failure rate? And it sounds like from the question is, because he asks, is an operational stoppage like a blockage count as a failure for this equipment? And I I don't know how many times you've had this discussion with people is where they go, well, what is a failure? Is this, do we count this and not that and this, that, and the other thing? And you know as well as I do is that most Pareto diagrams are dominated by no fault found or user error or some other euphemistic thing saying we're going to ignore that.
Right. Or customer induced failure, something like that.
Yeah, they actually had the timidity to turn the thing on, and it didn't. It had failed.
Yeah, I mean, right. And intermittents are very hard to decide, whether you count it. But, an intermittent, anything where you had to reboot the product, I mean, it was not a hard failure because it was not catastrophic. The unit comes back and functions normally.
Yeah, there's some reboots as you lose data, you lose production time.
If you
had to reboot your car in the middle of the freeway, it'd be life-threatening.
Reminds me now, cars start themselves and stop themselves at stoplights, and I go, whoa, why'd they do this? That's kind of weird.
What do we need a stoplight for?
Well, the engine turning off and then turning on when you...
Well, my hybrid did that years ago.
Yeah,
I had one of those.
Weird. But anyway...
I'm enjoying the 50 miles per gallon, You sit there and idle.
There can be several definitions for a failure. And, one of them is maybe a processing speed. If you slow down or you have some condition where it's a microprocessor or a digital system is dropping to a very low functionality, it takes, you know, forever to download something, that could be considered a failure. It's a matter of you defining it up front, you know.
Well, it's not you, the manufacturer or the designer. It's you need to understand what your customers are going to call a failure.
Right.
That's where I focus. Yeah. And that's what I answered the question by is like, you know, if you're in a plant, talk to your operations manager. You know, if you got a 5-second downtime where you have to clear a blockage, do they consider that a failure?
And right.
One plant I was in, they had blockages every 30 seconds. So it adds up to be like 20 minutes of blockage time every day. And like, that's a lot of, and they're doing bottling at 400 a minute or something like that. And it stops the bottling process.
Right. And I worked on, you know, in college, I was down in the basement of the Dr. Pepper headquarters on the canning line. And they do 1,000 cans a minute as it's running through. And there's all kinds of other functions that have to happen besides the cooling and sealing of the can, the cooling of the liquid, carbonation. Then it goes through
sterilization step on the outside of the can. And
well, that's a lot of, well, I mean, sterilization, but also to warm up the can, because when they put in the carbonation, it has to be very cold, almost ice cold, to hold in the carbonation while the can gets jostled and thing. And then it goes to be so that the cans are not cold when they're put in the cardboard cases, because condensation would cause the
cardboard
to fail. Right. So they're warmed up through that. And then they're go through an X-ray machine to show that they're filled completely, as obviously can't show. So we'd have this little air jet that would, you know, as the cans rush through this measurement device, you'd hear, you know, and it would
just can we push, get shoved out.
Yeah, it could shoved out with half empty, partially filled cans. And and then it would go down the line, and it was a long track. So I guess anywhere along that line, if something had, you know, gotten stuck or cans had jammed up, that would have been called a failure. But I was on the six-pack ring machine, and you had to, you know, they had three big, huge spools of six-packs in long tape
form. So you had to change the rules so they kept going and feed them into the system.
I had to quickly find the end of one of the continued spools and staple it to the last part of the one going through the machine and make sure it fed through. So any point of that, it could fail. And that would be a failure, but that'd be a user failure. If I sometimes forget to get there in time, you know, because they're running through and there's three huge spools on a big turn, kind of a big Ferris wheel, and one would be fed and you had to go load the other. So that could be a operator error if I had caused the blind to stop because I hadn't stapled the next tape to the next.
But you've been in all kinds of places where they say, all right, well, we're not going to count that. That was, you know, that was a Kirk error. We're not going to count that. You know, the production manager go, no. You shut the line down. That counts. And others, you know, the mechanical engineer for the actual machine that lines up the six cans and puts the rings on it,
right,
is saying, well, it didn't tear the rings and it actually got the alignment right and everything else. Mm-hmm. So that's not a failure. It's not a big deal. But they don't, you know, it's not the machine's fault. And that's what I went back to him and says, well, one, count every failure in some way or fashion. Every failure has information that you can make improvements on. And you might, on a production line, you might have, you know, 30 alarms going off, but if you can fix one of them, now you only have 29 alarms going off.
But you kind of know, you kind of know that what your cost per minute or what your profit, you know, in a line, in a production line, when it shuts down, you can almost make a business case that those costs, anything that causes, like the pallet machine, I remember it breaking. That was way at the end of the line where it would stack up cases on a pallet. Well, it's breaking or not being able to stack properly caused the whole line to shut down for, you know, an hour.
right, can't put boxes out there anymore.
Right. You can't have humans load it the way a machine can very quickly.
You didn't have humans that were willing or able to do it. No, they couldn't keep up at all.
No, they wouldn't be able to keep up. And then, you know,
there would be the I Love Lucy and the chocolate factory.
Shrink wrap it and all that. So, but yeah, that's part of the understanding of the whole process, the whole overview of, well, is it easy for the operator to do these things? You know, that's an opportunity for improvement. You know, can I get it to automatically, you know, should I make a automatic feeding system so this operator doesn't have to staple them? Of course, this was back in the 1970s, so yeah. They didn't, you know, but it was
lucky you weren't standing there trying to line up six cans and shove the rings on them.
Yeah,
at 500
yeah,
a minute.
Yeah, yeah, that, yeah, the old way. No, I'm always amazed at what these companies can build for production of that kind of volume and speed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When you're making that many and it's worth spending the millions or tens of millions of dollars for these bottling machines and different stuff, because it pays for itself in a day or two, you know. But when they go down, it's a problem. It's
costly.
It's costly. Yeah.
It's costly.
Up.
Right. So, you know, those are anything that I guess contributes to that.
Well, that's the issue is that if you only count everything, but you want to learn about that, the machine that puts the rings on, you know, is this meeting our objectives and what's the cost of running this machine and its maintenance costs and so on? Well, then don't count the bottling machine and don't count the pallet machine. Only count failures for that one machine if that's what you're interested in studying. If I'm the mechanical engineer, production engineer for that station, yeah, the other things are important overall, yet this is where I work. And so count that area.
Right.
But the idea of that distinguishing between operational failures versus production failures or, you know, throughput failures, if that's part of the study, if that's what you want to know to run the thing, it's not in general the top line, discount everything. And it's same in product reliability. When you get warranty returns, it's, oh, we don't know what it is, so we're not going to count it. I think is one of the worst responses I ever heard. It says, well, you gave me this tour. There's boxes and boxes of returns over there. What's your failure rate? Oh, it's 0.1%. Really? You got half your production from last week sitting out here as failures. How can that be? And they said, well, we don't count ones we haven't looked at yet. And we don't count ones that we don't want to look at, or we don't count ones that we think is customer abuse. And they just kind of ran down this whole long list of things going, oh, we don't count a lot of stuff. Why do you do that? Well, we want to have good failure rates.
Well, yeah.
Lost it at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, don't.
It's a production error. Like, that's not a real failure.
Well, yeah. This is kind of data manipulation. You know, it's just not being honest with your management. It's, you know, trying to say, they're looking for things to blame the outside world, not the internal operations, you know? So like this machine failed, and it was made by such and such, or this, you know, that's a failure. That's for sure. You know,
well,
that's
that can was out of dimension. That caused the failure.
Yeah.
It's not our fault. It's the cannery company that makes it.
Right. So, right. So it's looking of failure and blame, you know, that's always a difficult thing to,
it's something it's not to do if you want to actually make any improvement. Nobody likes failures, yet if you don't embrace them and deal with it and report it accurately, it's in the reliability maturity matrix that I've been talking about for decades now. Is the very low, the first stage is they have complete denial. This is in their summary is that something along the lines of, why do customers always have to complain? It's the customer's fault, always. And they just ignore every failure as they possibly can. And so their internal metrics are orders of magnitude better than what's actually happening. And they're blind to what's going on. And then some companies say, you know, we got a lot of boxes over there. How come our metrics don't cover that? We need to actually figure this out. And they get better and they get better and they get better. And then I had one client that they were, it was making a telecommunication test and measurement type system. And it was a fielded unit. It went off and measured, measuring a cell tower, some facet of it that I don't understand. And they were doing pretty good, but they mm-hmm. recognized that their overall reliability of their fielded systems was plateaued. It was at some mm-hmm. percentage and it wasn't getting better. And they were mm-hmm. like, what do we do now? Well, it's an interesting project, right? Well, what do you count as a failure?
All right.
And it was stuff that was diagnosed as a bad solder joint or mm-hmm. a bad board or a loose connector, stuff like that. But the loose connector, they discounted because it's like you said earlier, it's like if you reboot it, like your brother's pinball machine, mm-hmm. and it started working. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't count that failure. They said, wait a second. The customer had to call you, get a return authorization, ship it out to you. You paid for shipping, you paid for diagnostic, you found a loose cable, you reconnected it, retested the thing, and then put it back on the shelf or sent it back to your customer. He goes, yeah, we do all that. That cost you money. It cost mm-hmm. your customer the loss of the functionality of that device in the short term. That's a failure.
Loss in confidence of your quality. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a failure. And they go, oh, no. Nothing actually failed. This is the connector came separate. Was that, and they started waving their arms and waffling about it. Yeah. No, count that. Somebody calls for, I don't know where the on off switch is. That's a failure. And he said, well, that was in the user's manual. I said, it's still cost you money. It's That's a failure. Right.
You had to answer the question. Somebody had to call in and ask where.
Yeah, what's your model number?
Right. That could be it. I mean, it's really not a hardware failure. It's the fact that the failure or your
industrial design was non-obvious.
Right, not obvious, you know. And, the only reason I knew where the switch was on the pinball machine is because I've been playing for years and I know where things are and I have them myself. So, I was able to help him. But yeah, that would have required, he could have found out from the company. But
it takes you an hour to get a hold of half of these people. So it takes the customer time. It's not leading to customer satisfaction.
Right. So it may not be the hardware. It may be the instructions. It may be the industrial design. It may be a lot of things that cause that the customer send back a good piece of hardware thinking, they didn't understand it doesn't work because they didn't know the function of it or something like that. But
I had one of them that I got called into the production floor and on the docks, and it was a whole pallet of factory packaged printers. And mm-hmm. they're packaged like that to go to distributors that then go out to the different retail outlets and stuff. And it wasn't even broken down. And it was returned as, it was 150 printers on this pallet as all failures. And I said, wow. Did they not like the shrink wrap on it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I dug into it a little bit because it would be a big blip on our monthly failure rate kind of stuff. I'd have to explain it. And I talked about, this failure was a policy differential between return to stock, which had a 10% stocking fee, uh-huh. or if they claimed they were failures, they got 100% their money back. So there's something wrong in our ordering system and or our policy that is given as failures when, for all technical reasons, it's not a failure and it's never even attempted to be turned on.
Right. But it's a business. It's an economic. They're trying to get.
It's an economic problem, but if it's going to cost us money, it's a failure. And so I'm going to get involved with this. And my boss was like, what are you worried about that for? I says, it's going to cost us, $600,000 to deal with this because we have to unpackage it all according to our own policy. And make sure they all work and then sell them at a discount because they're used. It's still in the factory pack.
right. Yeah, I wonder what they returned them with an indication of what the failure mode was, you know, when they send back a pallet like that.
Oh, ESD. Yeah.
You know, yeah, ESD.
Something we just can't figure out one way or the other.
Like, yeah.
Okay. No, it was a wrong color.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, wrong color.
Which is a failure. If you create a product that is the wrong color and they don't buy it, that is a design failure.
What if they order the pallet with the wrong color? Okay, there's two different colors.
It's an ordering process.
It's an ordering process failure, right?
Yeah, it's an ordering
It can be in the system that it doesn't have anything to do with the hardware.
Yeah, no, and that's what I said. The best way I've ever, and it was somebody was telling me about it, is that if it costs us money, it's a failure. And one way to expand it away from. I have 100 units here and I found one resistor was bad. So I'm only going to classify one of the 100 of them as a real failure. Now, for the electrical engineer with that component or the assembly line that's assembling them, that may be relevant information for them. Yet for the overall business, those other 99 still cost us money. And so you can't ignore those. There's other reasons it came back to you or other reasons the line stopped. And it could be training, it could be awareness, it could be familiarity with your system, it could be on and on and on. And those are all still things that cost you money, stops the line or customer sends it back to you.
Right. And that's the bottom line is the cost. You know, if you you can make a business case for studying it and saying, look, this is costing us this much money. For these kinds of problems, we need to investigate further. But that's, you know, again, we've talked about the time companies don't realize the value they have in investigating further and asking the 5 or 10 whys, you know, this was returned. Yep. So there's sometimes that's just a cultural thing in the company. And you know, you got to work within that, too. So
I like the idea that was my answer back to this person. It was, you know, count everything and then break it down for different stations or different parts of your operation and so on. And then focus on a deeper dive and solving the ones that are the big hitters for you, the most important stuff.
Pareto everything. Pareto it and say, okay, this is user errors and why? Well, the instructions weren't clear in the manual. Okay. Or
nobody reads the manual. Come on.
Or the indicator light, you know, the lights were wrong, you know, something like that. So it's usually worth investigating if it happens, you know, as significant. It's again the 80-20 rule, right?
Yeah.
80% of the problems are caused by 20% of the
causes the different causes. I get it, but I knew you'd like this one because it's fun diving in on, you know, a really juicy electromechanical type failure mechanism and getting all the cool tools out and playing with it. And sometimes it's a policy problem.
Be aware. That's some companies, some industries make money off their failures, and they really aren't
It's
motivated.
It's a whole other podcast.
And there you can't do a whole lot about it. That's a cultural problem that you can't do much about.
It's a business model
problem. What's that? Dream the impossible dream, which is to try and...
Yeah. Well, anyway, that was a question that came in. I thought we'd have fun talking about that.
Sure.
Because we both love when stuff fails and what we do about it and get to deal with it. Except the stuff we buy, we just want them to work.
And
get a little frustrated.
Right.
But the idea is a question that came across, gave some answers to them. And now I got to go back and say, you know, if you want to dive into this, answer this a little bit better and some ideas of what you can do about it, take a look at the podcast or listen to the podcast. That'd be great. But if you are listening to this and have, you know, issues with what you count and don't count, you know, the culture in your organization or some other question about reliability and related stuff, we'd be more than happy to get you an answer or point you in the right direction or contact somebody, you know, get you in touch with somebody that can help you. Or Or more often than not, is that then we talk about it on the show and hopefully flush out even a deeper, more meaningful answer for you. So if you got something on your mind, let us know. And yeah, we're at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a couple ways to get in touch with it. Kirk and I and the other hosts are all available through LinkedIn and our about pages. So plenty of ways for you to get in touch. If you don't, we'll count that as a failure, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, we troubleshoot our own podcast. I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes we have to. Yeah.
Well, let us know, folks, what you think of our discussion here, and we appreciate you listening.
Yeah. Thanks, Kirk. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Fred.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.